All right, so David and his men, having escaped the dilemma of fighting with the Philistines against Israel and having traveled back to Ziklag, find a calamity. And this is oftentimes the case, isn't it, that we experience a deliverance only to find ourselves in the midst of another trial. Keeping in mind, at the beginning of this, we know that the Amalekites are the ones who have raided Ziklag. David and his men don't know this at this point. They just know it's been raided and everything is gone. All right, so think about this. It's David and 600 men. They're up with the Philistines, and their families are left back home, and it's while they're gone that these Amalekites come and take everything. Now, providentially, they didn't kill everyone, and they took everyone with them, keeping them alive. We see a similar situation with Abraham, one of the times that Sarah is taken, right? He says this is his sister, and she's taken by the king, and the Lord doesn't permit the king to touch her, right? And she's kept. And I think something like that is going on here. I don't think the practice of the Amalekites was to leave everyone alive and to preserve them. But in this instance, they did. So they attacked Ziklag, they burned it, they took their captives, and they went their way. So when David and his men come, they find this. It was burned and empty. They wept. It says that they wept until they had no strength left. Note, if you look at your map for a moment, this helps explain some of this. But, okay, David and his men, remember, departed Aphek up in the north. And they came all the way down to Ziklag, which is in the right on the border between Philistia and the dark green of Judah. So they had a long march, a long travel. They get there, they're probably already exhausted. And then they find that all of their loved ones are missing and their city is burned. And so they weep until they're exhausted. And it's at this point that they set out. And so that helps explain a little bit why there are these 200 men who are left, right? Left behind. All right, so David's wives are gone. And it says David was greatly distressed. Now, his distress is compounded because he's the leader, right? He is the head of this band. And he is the, you know, ruler of this city. And everyone's safety, everyone's well-being is kind of in his hands. And so he comes back. They've all been following him. And now their wives and children are gone. And they were so upset by it that they were going to stone David. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of the people was grieved, every man for his son and his daughter. It's not uncommon for people who experience tragedy to lash out, to look for someone to blame, to look for a place to direct that sorrow and that anger. And David is a natural target here because, again, he's the leader and he's led them into a position, whether his fault or not, it's natural that they would be upset with him. So David's response here is very helpful. David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Right? So David is being assaulted on many fronts by the Amalekites, by his own men. And he's also personally grieving. He's lost his wives and children. He doesn't know that they're alive at this point. He's lost the city that he negotiated with the Philistine king. So he's got his personal tragedies, and then he's got his own men wanting to stone him. And so what he does is he turns to the Lord. Right? He finds solace and strength in the Lord. By turning to the Lord, he probably prayer, right? Probably seeking God in prayer, probably worshiping the Lord. Think of Job after the calamity that befell him, and he's sitting there on the ashes of what used to be his household, and he praises the Lord, right? And that's what David is doing. More than that, he seeks the Lord. He calls for Abiathar, the high priest, who has the ephod, and he asks him to consult the Lord, and asked for direction. And he inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, and the Lord said, you will overtake them, pursue, and you will overtake them without fail, recover all. I think there is a lesson here in, you know, the responsibility of a ruler, of a man, of a husband, of men, in that they have to be the ones who protect and defend, even bearing the sword, in order to recover their families. This is a legitimate, you know, cause for violence. This isn't a legitimate use of strength. And I've said before, and I'll remind, that Christianity is not pacifist. Okay? Now, Christians are peaceful people. We don't seek conflict. We don't seek war. But there are circumstances such as this in which it is not only justifiable, but I think probably necessary, right? If David and his men did not pursue after their families, I think they would be derelict. They would be neglecting their responsibilities as men. And the Lord has given him an indication that he will be successful in this. All right, so we see then that there's this attack, this raid. Here's the aftermath of it. David, probably very close to despairing, seeks the Lord, strengthens himself in the Lord, and resolves to go after them. Now we find the pursuit of these Amalekites. They come to the brook Besor in verses 9 and 10. He started out with 600 men, and then he leaves 200 behind. And as we read, these 200 didn't stay behind because they were fearful or because they were rebelling or because they didn't want to fight, but it literally says they were too tired, they were too weary. And the reason why I showed you on the map, they came all the way from Aphek and down to Ziklag, found the raided city, and then immediately set out. Even strong soldiers would all be wearied at this point. And it's reasonable to suppose that out of an army of 600, there would be 200 of them who just simply couldn't go on. Remember, they wept until they had no strength left. So they're physically, emotionally, spiritually just exhausted. And so they agreed to leave them. And you can see the brook of Besor on your map there, Besor Brook. If you follow the green dashed line, returning from Ziklag and then pursuing the Amalekites, so they leave behind these 200. And again, I don't think we should view this as cowardice or an unwillingness to fight. They just, that was their limit. Keep this in mind. In any endeavor, in any group of people, whether it's a church or family or friends or anything like that, there are different capacities. Right? There are people who, or there are different circumstances or providences, you know. And David mercifully understands that these men, it's better for them to stay back with the equipment. They would not have been useful in the fight. And sometimes you just have to move on without everyone, right? You just have to make provision for them and make allowances. And so that's what he does. So he takes the remaining 400 and pursues. And along the way, he comes across this Egyptian. His men find this Egyptian who had been abandoned. And here we see kindness to a stranger, right? They bring him to David. They feed him. They find out his story. And he's a slave. He says young man, Hebrew na'ar, a servant, okay? He's a servant to an Amalekite. And he fell sick. And so he was left behind. There's a contrast here in the way that David treated his men and the way that the Amalekite treated his slave, right? David's men were left behind, but in a place on the way home. Right, David was going to pack by this brook again and pick them up on the way home, but this slave is left in the field. He just was left to die. You know, maybe left him a canteen and said, you know, pray to your Egyptian gods. You can't keep up. We're going to leave you behind. Now, there's a proverb that says the mercy of the wicked is cruel, right? And meaning they don't have mercy. They don't have that compassion. Now David does in this instance. He's also very wise, I think, in showing kindness to this Egyptian. because it benefits him. But also just, listen, David is going to go in and kill a bunch of people. But he also has room for mercy for a man who's been left to die. And you see this great juxtaposition here of a godly man who is willing to do violence and also willing to feed a man who's been abandoned. Sort of an interesting, you know, Israel at one time came out of Egypt and wandered in the desert, and now you have Israelites some years later finding this Egyptian left in the desert. It's, you know, probably would have been notable to Hebrews to read about this Egyptian slave, right, when Hebrews had one time been slaves in Egypt. So after they give him food and drink, he recovers. He hadn't eaten or drank for 3 days, so the timeline is this 3 days. You know, it took them maybe 3 days to get home from Aphek, and it was just 3 days that this slave has been left behind. So it's, they just kind of passed, you know, the Amalekites had just raided their place, and they're just right behind them. He tells his identity and what they've been up to. At this point, you know, this slave is an enemy combatant. All right, he was a participant in the raid. He would have enjoyed some of the spoils. He would have, you know, now granted he's a slave, but still, if this Egyptian had not fallen behind and been left in the field, he would have been among those whom David would kill when he found the Amalekites. But because he's defenseless and left behind, he receives compassion. Because of David's kindness to him, he vows to help him. He says he will take them to the troop. He has two conditions. Swear to God, Elohim, that you won't kill me and will not deliver me into the hands of my master. Because that also would probably result in death, right? That he would no doubt be treated harshly, his master. And notice this. This man just needed some food and water, and he was able to be useful. So that's how, you know, cruel his master was. So he vows to help. I don't know what became of this Egyptian slave. You know, did he go on his way after this and make his way back to Egypt? Did he get picked up by some other, you know, roving band? Did he join David and his men? I don't know. But this is sort of, you know, think of like the Good Samaritan, right? The Good Samaritan assists the person in need because in God's providence they were bound together. So the Egyptian then brings him to where the Amalekites are. And it's at this point that David learns in the story that it's the Amalekites. Now he's been conducting raids on the Amalekites before, so they already, you know, are enemies. One other notable thing. Verse 14, it says, we made an invasion of the southern area, the Kerethites, in the territory which belongs to Judah, and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. The Kerethites are Cretans. Okay. Later in the same chapter here, it's the land of the Philistines. I think Kerethite is the Amalekite designation for Philistines. And remember, the Philistines, as supposed, came from the island of Crete and made their way into the Levant, into Israel. This is always interests me, like in the New Testament, when Paul says Cretans are always liars and sluggards and lazy, right? He's talking about people who ancestrally are Philistines. And you know, we get that from the Old Testament. We understand that Philistines they have a particular reputation. All right, and then another thing that the servant says that's notable in verse 14, and we burned Ziklag with fire. See, he was a participant. He was, you know, a part of a corporate entity, right? So the Amalekites are in for a penny, in for a pound. Right, if you're with the Amalekites, you're counted as a part of them. So he acted, you know, they were, the Amalekites were a moral entity, and he was a part of it. But David, for the sake of what he wants to accomplish, overlooks that, forgives that, and uses the man's information. All right. So now David, in verses 16 through 20, defeats these Amalekites after the Egyptian brings him there. The Amalekites are celebrating. They're feasting and drinking and dancing, and they're spread all over the place because they've just had a great raid. And it's a good time for them to be attacked. And now David and his men attack at twilight and into the evening the next day. So that means it's, you know, starts out still dark, just getting light. They find them, they start attacking, and it goes until it gets dark again. And they're just slaying Amalekites. Meanwhile, all of the wives and children and all of the spoil has not been touched. It has not been destroyed or killed or used up. So David recovered in verses 18 through 20. He recovered his wives, and nothing of theirs was lacking. That's probably, we have to see the hand of God in that, right? That these Amalekites did not kill them or molest them or, you know, destroy everything. So David recovers everything, and he takes all the flocks and herds and all this livestock, and then David claims it. This is David's spoil. It's interesting. Let's see. Yeah, in verse 18, so David recovered, and David rescued, and David recovered, David took, and David set. This is David's spoil. Very much a represent, you know, David as representative of the whole, and this, he's very much being presented as a king. Okay. In the book of Ephesians, it says that Jesus Christ ascended and he took captivity captive and delivered gifts to men. And that's sort of what David is doing. He's acting the part of the king. And he takes captive the captives, and he takes the spoil then and delivers it to his people. And that's what, you know, Christ does that for the church, right? He delivers captives, us, and then gives us to each other. So we are, in a sense, Christ's spoils. So David says, this is David's spoil. And about you, Christ says, this is Christ's spoil. Right? He has taken you and rescued you, and now you are his to dispense. All right, now in verse 21, and following, we see this distribution of the plunder, or the spoils. Now there's a little bit of an Old Testament, Mosaic background to this. In the book of Numbers, there's a gaining of spoil, and it's divided up amongst Israel. And I wonder if I... So there, in this, in the book of Numbers, in chapter 21, there's... let's see if I have a marker that will work. Okay, so there's 12,000 warriors. And does anyone remember in the book of Numbers there was a census right before this? It was 600,000 and something, okay? And then the whole spoil is divided between these two groups. The 12,000 warriors get half of it, and then the rest of the nation gets the other half. So it's split evenly in half, except for, you know, the per capita for these 12,000 is slightly higher than the per capita for these 600,000, right? And then there's a 0.2% tax on these, and a 2% tax on these to the Lord for their spoil. In this instance, David and the 600 men are divided into 400 who went into the battle and the 200 that stayed behind. So you have... the 400 who went into the battle, and then the 200 who stayed behind, and David lumps them together. And then over here, you will see the all of his friends in Judah. Okay, so David is taking, and he takes and says, these are all counted as one, and then he takes and gives the rest to the people of Judah. So David is applying numbers to his current situation. Now, the issue in dispute is these 200, because the 400 who, you know, they're like the 12,000, but what about these 200? Well, David, I think, is partly generous, right? He knew that they fell behind not through a fault of their own, but just due a weaker capacity, etc. Also, they had been with him all this time up in Aphek, and, you know, they've been with him this whole time. They were his men, and he took care of them. Also, I think there's some wisdom in, suppose you have an army of 600, and 200 of them you disenfranchise. Now you have 200 men against 400 men. You can probably still defeat them, but that's not, it's better to continue with 600 well-fed men than maybe, you know, 300 well-fed men. So David wisely shares the spoils with both of them and then distributes to Judah. Let's see. Notice in verse 22, the wicked and worthless men objected. We're told, we don't have to speculate who was right in this instance. We're told by the narrator that the people who objected were wicked and worthless. And a couple of things just to remember about that is, one, even in a good group, right? David and his men are the good guys in this story. But even in that group, there are wicked and worthless men, right? There are bad actors even in good groups. But also, it's when it comes down, you know, the pressure point here are the spoils. They all rode together and they are all fine until the spoils got involved. And they think they're being generous. They say, give him his wife and children and let them lead away and depart. Okay? You wanted to stay behind at the brook. You were too tired to go on. Take your wife and children. That's enough. And you go away. There's a sense in at least in myself, where I think, yeah, that's right. They didn't go to the battle. They shouldn't get the spoils. I mean, you know, the one who works eats, right? But there's also something about solidarity and you know, being a part of something that when the whole succeeds, they all succeed, right? And when they fail, they all fail. You're in it together. But also something to remember for these soldiers is that when you have a public office of some kind, you do not work for your own benefit, right? So when you're a soldier, you're not a mercenary. You're not doing this for your own. You are doing it for the benefit, actually, of a nation, and that includes these others. When you're an army, you're not fighting for yourself. You're fighting for all of these. And the office of a public person is to bless the whole community. And it actually works out better for everyone that way, right? Because the whole, like, do you see what David is doing here, by the way? He's consolidating. He's building alliances. He's, you know, if you look at your map, and we won't go through all of the different cities and the people, the elders that he gave the spoils to, but you see that that dark green region, these are all the areas where David gave spoil. And an army is stronger when it is supported by more taxpayers. David is going to be able to recruit more soldiers. He's going to have more places for them to take refuge. It really works out better. So these 600 need to see themselves as servants of the whole. And that's how David is seeing himself, right? He calls it David's spoil, but then what does he do with it? He distributes it. There are in the list of people who are called, you know, the elders who are called David's friends, there are some omissions. One of them in the dark green area is Ziph. You see that there's, you know, Hebron got a cut, Carmel got a cut, all these other people did, but there's Ziph. They didn't get any. Do you remember the Ziphites? The Ziphites are the ones who went and told Saul where David was hiding. Is not David hiding here? So David is generous, right? He shares the spoils, but he also is not so foolish to enrich his enemies. So they don't get, and the same with Keilah, which is just a little bit north of Hebron. Keilah, you remember David rescued Keilah one time, and then he asked the Lord, are they going to turn on me? And the Lord said, yes. So they also didn't get a cut. So David is very, showing himself to be a very wise ruler, and he's good, you know, with diplomacy, and he shows mercy, and he does things that keep his army intact, but he also remembers what is, you know, who are his friends and who are not. I'm going to pause there for a minute. Yeah, go ahead, Bob, and then Karen. Yeah.
I was going to say, the other thing, too, with the 200, they've been running around with David, so they're not home taking care of their families.
Yes.
They have, it's just like, when, you know, if we send somebody off to some other country, so in the military, and one of them, and he gets injured putting equipment on a truck.
Yes.
Yeah, he doesn't get a Purple Heart like the guy who got shot.
Yes.
But we want to take care of him anyway, because he was there, he risked him, potentially risked himself. Anybody who signed up is risking themselves.
Yes.
And so with these men, they've already gone to the north and fought with him. Then they come back down.
Yes.
And they have, their families have suffered.
Yes.
Because of their service.
Yes.
So I think that's where it would have been very foolish for him not to give them part of the spoils, because they, like everybody else, took their chances.
Yes, that's an excellent point. And that David, as their ruler, has an obligation to them. He has taken them away from their families, and that doesn't change merely because they were not in this particular battle. And they, you know, bringing their wives and children back to them restores them in part, but it doesn't restore them for the time that was lost and for, right, all of that. So it would have probably been, as you say, unjust for David to not share the spoils with them. Karen.
I was going to say, it's an interesting contrast between the Egyptian slave when he said, we burned down Ziklag, and he probably, I don't know if he would know that, like, David, he could have been killed. Maybe he could have said, oh yeah, they did that, you know, or whatever.
Sure.
But then this, these wicked men, uh-huh, are like, hey, we got the spoils. And, you know, like,
yeah,
they're not including them in the...
They want to separate it out, according to, right? Yes, they don't want to be a part of. And this is a constant balance, I think, is between individual responsibility and corporate solidarity. And we have difficulties with this in families and in churches and in societies, you know, working that out, figuring out, you know, what obligation do we have as individuals to be responsible and take care of ourselves and work hard? Also, being a part of a larger community in which we take care of each other. And take, for instance, you know, a hot topic over the last decade is universal health care. In one sense, it's unjust because not everyone's health is the same. And one of the reasons for that is not everyone's lifestyle is the same. And so it's sometimes unjust for people who rarely need the doctor to pay for someone who does drugs and always needs the doctor, right? Or takes risks. Someone's a, you know, a skydiver. Well, they're more apt to be injured or killed than the person who is careful and takes their vitamins, right? So you can see the difficulty there of the individual versus the corporate. On the other hand, if you have a society that is cohesive, right, that is in it together, then you say, well, of course we're going to take care of you because you're a part of us. And it could very well be the case that I someday have something befall me and I might need your help. And this is why it's helpful, by the way, for societies to have a lot in common, to be relatively homogenous, to have a high level of trust, to have the same religion, to have the same morals and customs, because then they are more apt to provide for each other in that way. All right, let's see.
Great.
Yeah, go ahead, Grace.
I was just going to say, just how great to marvel at God's goodness and his sovereignty in this. Because a lot of people, we're not careful, we can read this as, man, they had such good luck, What good luck that, this life was good.
Yeah.
But in
yeah.
every single detail of this, we see God's providence for David.
Yeah.
And what a great insight into, like you've been saying, how God prepared him to be king.
Yes.
I mean, in some ways, these are the best days of David.
Right. It's on his way up that he's the best man.
He's on his way up, and God is preparing him, and you can see how this is going to set up the kingdom, and he is the king of God's choosing, the man after God's own heart. But it's not all on accident. It's all God's provision for him.
Yep.
And then I was, the Ebed is so interesting because I always thought of it just saying yes or no. And then but here, there's more information given. So, God spoke to him or,
somehow,
It is really interesting even with that.
Yes, and your point about God's provision was not overlooked by David. Look at in verse 23, when the wicked men, have their proposal. And he says, my brethren, you shall not do so. With what the Lord has given us, right? He sees this as a gift from God, who has preserved us, God has saved them, and delivered into our hand the troop that came. See, David acknowledges this whole victory is God's. It's God who made this possible, and the spoils they now have were a gift from God to them. Therefore, he sees it as important to distribute it with those parameters, right? It's kind of like when we give tithes and offerings in church, we start with the recognition that the things we have were first given to us. What do we have that we did not receive? And that helps our joyfulness in giving, right? Being like, I'm only distributing things that God gave me. And so David recognizes that. And so you're right, David's ascent to the throne are really when we see the best of his character, I think. It's after he arrives that he has more trouble.
And just, Rick, just before you go on, imagine the immensity of those spoils. That's what struck me. I mean, he is distributing this to, you've got the whole list here.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm sure he wasn't sending $100 to each person.
Right, it was substantial.
I mean, he's getting substantial gifts and all the places. And so, and all of that came from the raids that he had been doing, and they've been stockpiling it, and all that. So it's just, you're in awe of what God has done for him.
And these Amalekites, so they raided David's city and all the spoil that David had there from his raids, right? But they also invaded other places and had all of that spoil. And then remember that there's a small remnant of the Amalekites who escape, and that's 400. Right, and we're not told how many Amalekites there were, but we're just told about this, these few who squirted out, and that's 400 on camels. Okay, so there was, a large supply that was recovered. Yeah. Well, any other questions or thoughts?